Welcome to the Time Shifters Podcast. This is Christopher in studio. Now, I know last time I told you that Matt and I would be discussing Howard the Duck this episode. Well, we forgot about a couple of really cool things that were going to happen before we could record next. The first thing is the 35th anniversary celebration of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. Paramount Pictures put this Trek classic back in theaters for a limited run, and friend of the podcast Floyd and I went to one of the showings. I took along the trusty recorder, and we had a little bit of a Trek talk. We recorded briefly before the film started, to discuss our memories of seeing the film for the first time, and where we saw it, and to talk about our hopes that it would still hold up on the big screen. Standard disclaimer, I was out and about with just an open microphone, so the quality's going to reflect that. Everyone, this is Christopher, the Time Shifters Podcast, and what you'll discover here shortly is that I am in a movie theater here at, what's the name of this theater? First of all, let me just tell you, I am here with a frequent contributor and friend of the podcast, Floyd, and what's the theater?
It's Regal Deerfield.
Regal Deerfield, there you go. We are here to see the final chance we're ever going to see Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan on the big screen. I'm excited as hell. Have you seen it on the big screen?
Yes, I saw it in its first run on the big screen.
All right. See, that's the advantage that you have is being a little older than I am.
There is advantage to age.
Now, I do apologize. I hope you can hear us okay. I'm trying to keep the mic close to us because we got some ridiculous previews going on here. Now,
hey, it's Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen. Yeah. That's all we need.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, maybe it'll get quiet now. This was awesome. Yeah, for me, the first Star Trek film I think I saw in a theater was probably 4.
Voyage Home?
The Voyage Home, yeah. I missed a lot of the good Star Trek stuff. I was too young. I was still in high school, that kind of thing. Didn't have the disposable income that maybe you college kids did at the time.
I think my parents paid for it.
Oh, well, there you go.
I think. I do remember seeing it in my hometown, though. I remember seeing it in my hometown theater.
Awesome. This is, you know, of course, fan favorite film.
Oh yeah.
Of the classic Star Trek. This is like fan favorite. What I mean, you know, it's funny. I was going to say why it holds up, but I don't think it really even matters why, you know, what are the reasons. I think it's amazing that no matter how many times we watch this, which version we watch, we're going to see the director's cut, which is what it's called here. I think kind of the extended few extra scenes here and there. Yeah. But even without, whichever one we see all the warts and everything, and, you know, we still love this film.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think of all the Star Trek films, it harkens back to, it continues a story that was already told.
Yeah.
And like, it's the pacing, the story itself, the obviously the great special effects and the characters and Ricardo Montalban, who does a great job reprising his role. I remember in an interview he said that that he had to watch the episode again because he was playing him like Mr. Rourke.
Oh.
Playing Tom like Mr. Rourke.
Welcome to SETI Alpha 5.
Yeah. So he had to watch the episode again. And he does a great job doing that. And I think that this movie was so good that it was kind of, I know for me, I was expecting the other movies to live up to it. And sadly, none of them really did. And there were still plenty of good Star Trek movies in there, but none quite captured the magic of this one.
I think it's interesting when you see like the motion picture and how, I mean, honestly, I guess, you know, cerebral is the word that gets thrown around a lot, and it is very Star Trek.
Oh yeah,
but it's not the kind of movie that you want to see in the theater. I mean, I think that thing in the extended version in the theater would have put you to sleep, especially in seats like this. We're in recliners, people. Really turned it on its head. They said, okay, let's do a 180, and they made effectively an action film.
Yeah.
And then actually what I think is cool is then when they did the third film, they backed off a little bit. Said, okay, it's going to be action, but it's going to be a little bit more heady.
Yeah.
And then they kept going, and they said, okay, now we can move back into doing the Trek. We can go back into doing these sort of morality tales and wrap it into the sci-fi and everything. But it was this film that allowed them to do it.
Oh,
I think if they
didn't try this, you wouldn't have had the series of the original cast Star Trek.
No.
The motion picture would have been just blip and considered a failure. And we probably wouldn't have The Next Generation. We wouldn't have Voyager, Deep Space Nine, any of the versions, any of the Star Trek that came after. It was really because of this film.
Because I think that if they would have continued with what they had done with the kind of strange uniforms and that slow pacing of the motion picture, then it wouldn't have gone probably past the second movie.
That's what I'm saying. I don't think it would have gone past that first movie. It's simply
no, put. Probably not. They would have continued the same vein. Yeah.
Oh, right.
It wouldn't have. Yeah. But you mentioned the second or the third and fourth ones, and Star Trek III. After two, I was expecting it to be as good. Star Trek III: The Search for Spock to be as good. And it's one of those where when I first saw it, I thought, well, this wasn't nearly as good. But the more I've watched it, the more it's grown
on
me.
It grows on you, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And my favorite scene of any of the Star Trek films is the stealing of the Enterprise.
Yeah, it's hard to beat.
Yeah, that with the James Horner music and just the pacing of that, and Stiles being so confident in his ship, and then it coming to grinding to a halt when the computer says it's at maximum velocity.
Yes.
Great stuff.
That is fantastic.
And then the fourth film, which is the one you said you first saw, was just a lot of fun.
Okay, hey, let me interrupt you because the lights are going dim, so we're going to start a movie quick. Yeah. When was the last, how long has it been since you've seen this?
35 years on the big screen.
Right.
But as far as on any other, it's probably been at least 10.
Okay, a decade.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah,
right. I probably watched it 2-3 years ago, but of course on at home, on the TV or whatever. So it's going to be fun to see how we think it holds up on the big screen here.
Oh yeah,
especially you, if it's been that long since you've seen it. This is going to be cool. So I'm going to shut the recorder off for now, and then we're going to watch the movie and we'll come back with some thoughts.
Yeah.
Well, we were not disappointed. The film looked fantastic and was just as enjoyable as ever. Well, I guess you can hear our thoughts for yourselves as we fired up the recorder again for a conversation in the parking lot.
All right, post-movie. We have just finished watching Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan on the big screen. So you said you saw it the first time 30 years ago, right?
Yes.
This is the 30th anniversary.
35th.
35th, sorry. You saw it 35 years ago, not to date you.
But no, my wife already took care of that and I married her, so.
Okay, so compared to what you remember when you first saw it on the big screen, does it still hold that, I love watching this on the big screen kind of feeling?
Well, when it first opened and the music first started, I got goosebumps.
Yes. You can't help it. I love the real orchestral opening Star Trek sting.
Yes.
When you hear that, I love hearing it. It just, I sat there, I was saying the same thing. I was thinking, I was listening to that music and I'm thinking, now I just want to listen to nothing but Star Trek music. Yeah.
I mean, it was similar to that initial feeling was similar to when I saw Star Wars Episode I.
Sure.
And it said, in a galaxy far, far away. It's like,
right.
Star Wars.
It's Star Wars.
Yeah. Sadly, that movie didn't.
Well, it didn't quite live up to the expectations.
Yeah, but it was similar where it's like, this is Star Trek. You've not already seen it.
Right.
This is Star Trek. And yes, it was just as gorgeous on the big screen now as it was back then.
Now, I'll go out and I'll tell you, I've told the other people, this is my Enterprise, too. This is my favorite version of the Enterprise. The 1701 movie version Enterprise from Wrath of Khan, blue sensor dish, the works. This is my Enterprise. So seeing it on that giant screen. I mean, I love looking at it anyway.
Yeah.
But when you see it on that big screen gliding overhead, the volume was just right on all the sound. I think that's the thing I'm taking away from this isn't so much the picture, isn't so much seeing it on the screen, feeling it in the theater, hearing the sounds, hearing everything that you, I mean, there is lines that I remember kind of almost sort of struggling to hear sometimes on TV. Clear as day here in the theater. Just the little asides by some of the cast or some of the sound effects you maybe don't always get when you're watching it at home. This one, absolutely, you hear it all.
Yeah, when the Enterprise is leaving space dock, just absolutely majestic.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, what other show have you seen a ship leaving a dock of some kind that is that majestic? What other movie? Well, I can't think of any.
I could probably come up with a couple of examples, but you know what? They were all mimicking,
yeah,
you know, yes. Star Trek.
Yeah.
Of course, this was a sort of a shortened version of the motion picture space dock scene. They just kind of edited it down a little bit. The motion picture. I personally love the space dock scene in the motion picture. Some people say it's long and drawn out. I'm like, this is why I'm here.
Well, exactly, because you're seeing the Enterprise on the big screen for the first time.
Yeah,
that's
true.
I got to see it on the big screen. So for the first time, it had been 10 years since last time it was, and it was a refit, so it was obviously, it looked a little different than the TV version. And it was big and beautiful and detailed, and yeah, you want to see it for a long time. So since this was your first experience seeing it on the big screen,
sure.
To it, was it as good as you hoped it would be?
Absolutely. And like I said, I think even better, just because of the feeling you get being immersed by all the sound, being able to hear everything, see everything. This was the extended, so you had a couple of the extra lines by some of the characters, which they didn't need to be there.
No.
Those lines didn't need to be there. But what was great is those are the kind of lines that really kind of helped. That's who these characters are. Most of the lines were like Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and their interplay between them. And they get kind of cut out and dropped from a lot of the versions or cuts of this film. And they don't need to be there.
No.
But they are the things that just kind of make those characters who they are with each other.
And having seen the movie many times, I could pick out every single one of those scenes and lines that were added.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
No, not were added, were put back in.
Right, yeah, there
and
you
they
go.
Were, they had been edited out. And I did think, though, that the when Savick asked the question, what happens if he doesn't follow us into the nebula? Kind of falls
yeah,
into
I completely
nebula.
Missed that. I forgot about that being excised.
Yeah, that wasn't in there. And I thought, that would have been okay.
Yeah.
The others, I can see why they got edited out, but that would have been okay.
The only thing I can think of is they cut it out because it doesn't necessarily work because in the end, he starts slowing and they have to goad him to come in. So I'm thinking, oh, well, that's kind of why. Oh, yeah, he's definitely going to follow us. He's not following us. Oh.
Yeah. I think what Savick just added just a little bit to that.
Yeah, maybe.
Like he thought about the possibility. Oh, yeah, that's happening now because Spock said, no, he will.
Yeah, sure, you got to poke his ego a little bit there.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, oh, wait, he's not following us in here. But the special effects still hold up on the big screen
they
today.
Do. I mean, this isn't like remastered or anything. This
and you
is
could,
just...
You could tell because it didn't have that brightness of a remastered. It didn't have that little extra Christmas of a remastered. This is what it was 35 years ago.
And it's all physical model work and then camera effects. And then obviously there's some digital trickery and everything to get all the, and everything. But it is, there's just that tactile presence that everything has when it's on the screen. Because that was really there in front of the camera.
Yes. And that holds up so much better than CGI back in the early days when it looked good then.
Yeah.
But today it doesn't look all that good.
Even something 10 years from the point of this film, you start seeing like some of the computer graphics. Like think of like Babylon 5 in the 90s.
Yeah.
Doesn't hold up today. It looks like something from the 90s.
Yeah.
This looks like it could have been produced yesterday. And it really does.
Yeah, the models just give it, like you were talking about, the tactile and the sense of placement. And the fact that they can put the cameras right on these things and you can't tell they're models.
Yeah.
Is just a testament to the artistry of model making.
You almost kind of refuse to believe that they're models. Because when you like the close-up shot, when Enterprise pulls up next to Regula and breaks, and you can see all the individual plates, on the hull.
Yeah. And as I was watching this, I realized that there were some concepts that were never carried over into the other films, like Kirk's love for antiques.
Well, maybe a little bit by Star Trek 4, where he sells his glasses that
gets as a gift. That's true, but that's probably about it. I mean, that's really not really... And the one thing that was cut out in the film, but was put back into this one, was how old the glasses were.
Oh, yeah. That was 400 years old.
Yeah. And which actually kind of, if they kept that in, that would have made when he sold them, tried to sell them in Star Trek 4, a little more, well, made that a little more meaningful. Yeah, like, wow, these are really old glasses.
Well, they're 400-year-old glasses with plastic tips on the...
Yeah, but...
And I like the, you know, it's hard to find them with their lenses intact. I'm like, are you telling me you happen to find just the right 400 pair of glasses for Kirk's particular astigmatism whatever?
Yeah. But the, and the, when I was seeing sick bay and they had all the injured, especially all the injured engineering crew in there, you know, that was never really shown ever again either. Just the, what it's like to, for combat in space for those getting injured.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you do with them? Where do you put them? Yeah. And they're on the tables. They're on the floor.
Yeah.
For an attack that savage the damage.
And, and when they showed the Reliant attacking the Enterprise and the doors closing and things blowing up and everything, and I don't ever recall ever seeing that before in a film back in the early 80s. Like, I mean, the things blew up like in Star Wars like that, but as far as...
The panic among the
panic,
men kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, certainly not in something... I'm sure in some, you know, in a war movie.
Oh, yeah, but a war movie.
But some out of science fiction or whatever, no. Right. Probably not. I think you still had a lot of the stalwart, oh, we're the heroes or whatever.
Yeah.
Unless you call... Let's see, this was 82, was it?
Yeah, 82.
So, unless you... I mean, I don't know. I mean, science fiction was still on the big screen... fairly rare if it wasn't Star Wars, and you had Alien in 79. Still wasn't a whole lot of science fiction on the big screen.
Yeah.
So I think this definitely set some groundwork.
And it made the hero vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Kirk even admitted it. You know, I did nothing except getting caught my britches down.
Yeah, that was something that I thought was pretty cool, is this really does make Kirk a human, where he was always just the hero, I can do anything, the brash young captain of the Enterprise. And this one was actually, he's a man. You know, he has feelings. He's feeling old. You know, he's like, we could all relate with this guy.
Calls himself senile.
Yeah.
and one thing I noticed, and this didn't strike me until I saw this again, was that with the Moby Dick, of course, you know, this is Khan being Captain Ahab. But that theme is brought up again in... First Contact.
Was it?
Yeah, because when Lily Captain Ahab has to kill his whale, you know, because she's wanting him to blow up the Enterprise.
I forgot about that. Yep.
Yeah, and that didn't strike me until just now that was visited again.
Funny story. Senior year in high school, we in English class, we were studying Melville's Moby Dick. And so we were reading some passages from the books and this and that and everything. Well, my English teacher, being a very cool English teacher, decided we should watch a film. And rather than watching, you know, one of the classic Moby Dick, he brought in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Nice.
So we get to watch that in class over the course of a couple of days.
Wow. I was never that lucky. But I did get to see it on the big screen when it first came out.
Yeah, you got to see it on the big screen. I got to see it on
the
projector.
That was carried over, and the actors did such a great job in this film with their actions, especially when Chekhov turns that belt buckle around and sees SS Botany Bay and the look on his face.
Oh yeah,
you know,
despite the fact that he wasn't in space.
Yeah.
That's one of the warts.
Yeah,
you know, there are issues in this film.
Oh, yeah.
There are. I mean, if you are a kind of like a student of Trek, you can pick out some mistakes. There's serious. The plot does show itself sometimes. Oh, you're going to have to come down here, or he could beam you up. You know, or you can't even beam us back, or you could beam over because you're in a transporter room.
Why didn't he do that?
Yeah, but who cares?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can
because the plot said so. That's why you can.
Yeah, you can overlook those things.
Yeah.
They could have explained that with perhaps a Reliance power was damaged enough to where maybe the transporter was good for.
Oh, yeah. You know,
one transport.
A simple line thrown in.
They could easily explain that. Like,
I don't need it, though. I don't need it explained.
Exactly.
That's fine.
Exactly. But they could have. Like with Chekhov, that's been suggested that he was actually on the Enterprise.
Right. We just didn't see him. He wasn't a bridge crew
exactly.
yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll go with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll go with that.
There's 400 men on that ship. Yeah. Come on.
One of the things we've always been pointed out is the moving bloodstain on Kirk's uniform.
Oh, yeah. Kind of rises and falls depending on the scene.
It was down below when Scotty's nephew grabs him, and then it was up a little higher in subsequent scenes. But, I never noticed that the first time I saw the film. But
We're outside, in case you didn't notice. Yeah.
But... And I love Khan's reaction twice when he found out Kirk was still alive.
When
he thought he was
dead. Oh, Montauban just.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Especially.
So good. Oh, big one.
Yeah. Especially the second time when Kirk's on the Enterprise.
Yeah. Try it your way, Khan. Game for a rematch.
I'm laughing at the superior intellect.
Montauban plays it so well. Yeah. He really does. Yeah. I mean, it had to have been such a joy to come back. And you're like, hey, we want you to play this part, and we want you to just, take it to 11.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you're like, I can do that.
And there's no hint of Mr. Rourke in there anywhere.
No, I don't think so. It is strictly Khan.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And
Everyone's at the top of their game.
Yeah.
I really do think so. I mean, they really all come back into their characters. And this is really where they start actually getting a chance to really shape their characters, where it's not just, okay, you're going to do this, and then next week we're going to start fresh because it's a new episode.
Yeah.
I mean, this, they, without knowing it, I think that's maybe they didn't realize they were doing it, but they were setting up their characters because, we saw there was a brief little interview in the beginning before this film.
Yeah.
And they were talking that, every time there was a Star Trek film, they figured that was going to be the last Star Trek film. So these guys were coming on and doing this part, and they had no idea that they were going to be able to be this character again.
Yeah.
But so every time they did, I think they got to add a little bit more. And then the next time they got to add a little bit more. But it all started with Star Trek II here. Mm-hmm. They got to, who are we kind of thing, and got to kind of start setting the groundwork for it.
And that became the norm for the movies of the Star Trek with the uniforms and everything, and those uniforms carried over to the Next Generation.
Sure.
Somewhat. I mean, you saw versions of them in the Next Generation.
Let me ask you this. 35 years ago, of course, there was not the internet, the media hounds and all, the media wasn't as big. There was maybe some stuff on the radio or whatever about, is Spock really going to die or whatever. You go in the theater, were you sitting there the whole time waiting, okay, when does he come out? When does he get better? He's dead already. Oh, but he's getting up, so it's all right.
Yeah,
I mean, did you have that?
Uh-huh,
I remember that the first time
I thought,
saw it.
Are they killing him off already?
In the beginning.
They're in the Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah. Wasn't that we thought was going to be like the big gag? Oh, Spock's going to die. And in the first 5 minutes, there he's dead. Oh, he's not. But even in the end, I remember thinking when the first time I saw it that, Spock's dead. He's dead already. But then you see him get up, and I'm thinking, he's okay.
Yeah.
And then he actually does die. But 35 years ago, what did you think when you did you? Were you waiting for him to come out of that chamber at some point?
Not, I think. When I think initially yes, but then when Kirk goes over to him and Spock walks right into the wall, I realize he's blind now.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do know that he had that second eyelid, but I don't think it was
gonna save you from radiation.
Help him, radiation, yeah. And when I first saw it, I honestly felt that the death scene was tacked on just because Leonard Nimoy didn't play the part anymore.
Mm.
It felt like it was just kind of. I'm thinking, is radiation there? Surely they have ways to vent it. They have suits they can put on. They have some way where someone unprotected.
It's another one of those moments where the plot kind of gets shows up.
Yeah, but I got it. And but I remember. So it really didn't bother me, didn't affect me that much, until Kirk's old eulogy, and he got choked up.
Yeah, yeah.
When he got choked up, he was most human. Mm-hmm. I got a little choked up.
Sure.
And tonight we saw it on the big screen. I felt more emotion for, even though I've seen it many times, I felt more emotion for the death scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Than I ever have.
I think the part that always, always kind of gets me is, Kirk's, just kind of stumbles on the word human, but then you hear Sulu, do his all those, and his voice quivers. I'm like, that's what really gets you.
Yeah, and I think tonight I started thinking that Kirk is watching his friend die right in front of him. His friend of many, many, many years, who has saved his life many times, He's watching him die, and there's not a thing he can do about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the first time I saw the film, I was coming to some point that's always just seems tacked on because Leonard Nimoy doesn't want to do Spock anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But tonight I was watching it, wondering what Kirk was going through, mm-hmm. and I think that's why I felt more emotion,
right,
with it. And that's really a testament for how well this movie stands up when you can watch it again 35 years later on the big screen and still feel emotion.
Yeah.
Even though you know how it's going to end, you know Spock's going to come back. Spoiler alert: Spock comes back in Star Trek 3. but even though you know how that works, I mean, it's like seeing Apollo 13 when you know those astronauts come back.
But you're watching the film, going, "Oh my God, are they going to make it?"
Yeah, and then when they get radio contact, you see the capsule going, "Yeah." Even though you know ahead of time.
Sure.
And like this, you know ahead of time, Spock's going to come back, but I still felt the sadness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how well it was actually done.
Oh, yeah.
And now it doesn't feel tacked on.
No.
Like it did,
no,
like I thought it felt like.
The only other death that has affected me more in the Star Trek universe was probably in Star Trek 3 when they blew up the Enterprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
My favorite character.
That one got to me, too.
That was my favorite character.
And when Kirk says, "My God, Bones, what have I done?"
Mm-hmm.
He says, "What you always do, turn death into a fighting chance to live."
Yep.
And so they carried that theme over too, whereas this time Kirk was
patting himself on his back.
Beating death.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I don't think he's patting himself on the back. Even
not for that one.
Yeah, not for that one because he blew up. He blew up his ship.
Been his home for 20 years.
So yeah.
So
they carry. They did carry over some themes, and of course, mm-hmm. before they kind of lightened it up, and it got to be fun.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. No, this is a great, you were talking earlier, you were discussing how the film and how the pacing and everything. I was kind of surprised. I didn't remember how many rises and falls this movie has. It is a roller coaster ride,
mm-hmm.
because you kind of get up, you're like, "Oh, my action, explosion, and
yeah.
then we're going to bring you down a little bit.
Yeah,
we're going to
yeah.
talk for a little
yeah.
bit, and then, yeah. oh my God, we're going back up again."
Yeah.
I kind of forgot. I kind of kept thinking, "Oh, we're getting to the end." Oh, no, we're not. No, we're not.
And I like how well the writing was done. That when the Enterprise is approaching the Reliant for the first time, we know what's going on.
Sure,
but Kirk and his crew, they have no idea what's going on, and so Kirk is, he's like, "This is damn peculiar,"
yeah.
And so he's being kind of cautious, and he's shocked because he doesn't know. He's like, "This is one of our own. What is going
yeah.
on here?" And especially, and I love that when he says, when Spock says, "Not up against their shields," he says, "Oh, who the hell are they?" because he has no clue. Why are they being attacked by one of their own ships?
I remember, or I don't remember, when I was watching this, I was really struck at how much kind of some really great scenes are sort of diminished by the fact that we have credits in the beginning of the film. Because even though you might have had it on the poster, you might see something starring or whatever. Can you imagine without all the credits, without all the people, with all the things going, and Ricardo Montalban is Khan and all that stuff and everything? I mean, obviously the title of the film kind of gives it away, but how incredible the scene would have been when, the guy starts peeling off his mask and he pulls it off and, "Oh my God, that's him."
I mean,
if there was a way to shield yourself from like the title
yeah.
of the film
yeah,
and all the credits, that would have been an amazing scene for a Trek fan.
Oh, it would have been. Yeah, that would have been fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And really, they probably could have at least done the previews in such a way to where it showed some battles and without ever revealing that it was Khan.
Right. Yeah.
They changed the title.
They had to call it something
else. Yeah, they changed the title.
Just Star Trek II.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe Star Trek II: The Vengeance.
Yeah, The Vengeance. Oh, yeah. There you go. The cold dish of vengeance.
Oh,
yeah.
I like it. Star Trek II: The cold dish of vengeance. Yeah.
That sounds too like, I don't know. Bruce Willis would star in that
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, yeah, but that would have been great if that reveal, you don't know who it is, and of course that would have been major secrets. They would have kept.
Or even that whole scene, that beginning where he, like you were saying, where he pulls the belt buckle and recognizes Botany Bay.
Yeah.
Where does that sound familiar? Yeah. Wait, what is it? Oh
yeah.
My God!
yeah, that'd be great if the audience like, "Oh crap!"
Yeah,
and even then we knew that Khan, Wrath of Khan, that he was going to be in it. But really didn't know how he was
sure,
going to be in
right.
it. So when they're on there and he does that was still Oh, that's where he is.
I mean, we've talked about it. There are issues with the plots. There are moments when the plot shows up. There are people will like to point out that the Chippendale dancers that make up Khan's crew are all 30 years younger than Khan is and everything. And yes, it's kind of one of these things where we all have to sit there and go, yes, we know, but trust me, it's a great film despite all of it.
Oh, yeah.
That's what amazes me. That's what I think is a good gauge of a film is how much can you just ignore? How many problems can you ignore and still walk away going, that was awesome?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this film is that example of that.
And if it wasn't that good, you'd be picking it apart with those kind of problems.
Yeah. Yeah. I can address those problems. I can agree that they're there. I don't care. It's a great film.
Yes.
Yeah. And honestly, the more I watch it, the more I kind of like, well, you could do that. Or why didn't they just beam right out from the cargo containers or whatever when they realized
first time I saw it, I thought that too. Like, why couldn't they have just called to beam out? But there's a lot of wind going on down there. I mean, it could have been interference.
Yeah, there you go.
Interference. They couldn't.
That's why they had to beam down where they did.
Because they couldn't have beamed out from the cargo carriers.
Right. See, that's the kind of stuff we fans have to just keep justifying.
A lot of it I think could be explained with additional line of dialogue or two, but the age difference of the crew of Khan's people. No, that couldn't be explained.
In my head, I mean, they put it 15 years from Space Seed.
Yeah.
Even though, what would it actually have worked out as? I guess it really is only about 15 years from the
15 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think they could have projected it further out, maybe. I guess they didn't have a problem with the age of the actual crew and everything. Because in my kid head, I'd always thought, oh, those are the descendants, the children of the Khan.
Oh,
but
yeah,
then they wouldn't be old enough.
No.
So, yeah. Yeah. The things you put in your own head.
And there's only one of them that had any lines anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Joachim. He was the only one that had lines.
Mm-hmm. The Phoenix.
And one scene I always thought was just kind of funny. The Reliant went into the nebula and, shook the bridge.
Get the bump.
And the guy behind
Khan kind of hits his shoulder.
Hits him
and you see Khan? What the?
Yeah, yeah. He looks back and the guy just like pulls his hand back.
Sorry, sir. My bad.
Yeah. I thought that was obviously that was planned because they didn't actually shake the bridge set.
They didn't break the set. No, they didn't really have a lot of. Well, they had a couple where the camera does the big tilt.
Yeah.
They didn't do the shaky side-by-side stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I forget. One of the films is in the Next Generation movies. They finally actually come up, put a bridge on gimbals.
Yeah.
So they could actually shake the bridge setup. I can't remember which one they did that.
Galaxy Quest did it, so Star Trek should certainly.
Yeah. But it wasn't Wrath of Khan, so any shaking was done by cameras and people acting.
Yeah. And they know how to do it. It's the experts. Let the experts have it,
And when the Enterprise starts listing. So mm-hmm. that was really cool with the camera going and people.
Yeah, that's I actually like when they do that with the and you see it a lot in here Wrath of Khan, both on the Reliant set and the Enterprise set. Is the Enterprise is it's doing it's listing like you were saying that inside you see the deck tilt in that direction too. I really like that they added that little touch.
And I love the quiet moments when they're in the nebula where you just see where the two ships are in relationship to each other, like one's up. I'm going up here, and we're on audio.
Audio,
one's up high, one's down below, and you see that they don't know.
Oh, it's still a fantastic tense. It's a submarine battle.
Yeah, exactly. And those scenes in the nebula are just gorgeous.
Still, like you were saying, still hold up today.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see any hint of matte lines or anything. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous.
This is a film that it would be fun to show a younger fan or a younger sci-fi fan or not, because I think there are these moments, like in the nebula, when they're seeing, and the ship, all of a sudden the Reliant shows up, you're like, move.
Hard starboard.
Yeah, or when the Enterprise so slowly rises up behind the Reliant and the music swells.
Yeah,
we talked about that before, James Horner, the music in this film.
It's just amazing.
It is amazing. I think it's a little wasted in the opening credits. You get a really action music in the credits, and it's a real slow starscape, and it almost kind of puts you off a little bit.
Yeah.
But that music, when it's in the film, is amazing. I mean, it's perfect. I love the they're almost Klingon-like music.
Oh, yeah, when
for the Reliant yeah, theme yeah. or whatever
yeah.
versus the Star Trek
I guess
theme.
That's called the, I guess you call that the enemy music.
The enemy music.
Yeah. But, yeah. And,
you know what the music I noticed, which I really liked because it really took me back to, like, the original series, is the soundtrack that plays real subtly in the whole moments where, like, Khan is interrogating Chekhov and Terrell. Mm-hmm. There's this really great music playing the whole time, mm-hmm. and it's really reminiscent of some of the stuff you would get from, like, the original series, because the original series was rarely quiet. It always had some sort of underlying music. When people would start saying stuff, you'd get these little music stings under what they were saying, and yeah. it really reminded me of that. I'm thinking, this is why this film made it. I mean, this is because it just these little subtle, you know, throwbacks to the original series that you may not even be noticed unless you really pay yeah. attention.
And the I love about James Horner music. I mean, he did it in The Wrath of Khan. He did it again in Alien, or Aliens rather. And that he's just a master at the. I'm not even sure how to describe it. It's just that, dun dun dun. You know, it's that like constant hitting of instruments building up to
mm-hmm.
an explosion or an end, something, you know, like in Aliens, it was during the armored transport.
Oh, sure.
When mm-hmm. they were getting out of the hive,
right?
You know, coming out of that, it was, and then they finally escape, and then it ends, and this it was like before the nebula blew up,
mm-hmm.
and the Genesis device blew up. But I mean, he's just a master at just that driving. You know, something is happening. I mean, he's just right there in the moment, and I mean, it's just so good.
Yep. And like I said, his take on Alexander Courage's, you know, Star mm-hmm. Trek
oh, yeah.
sting there, the mm-hmm. dun da da.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
and then
chills.
Yeah.
Goosebumps down the spine.
And then when Spock's dying, you know, he interjects the Alexander Courage,
mm-hmm.
Courage's theme, you know, right in there, right at the perfect time.
The man's
just a master.
Yeah, he did a fantastic job. Yeah. And I mean, there are times where you think I think he writes a paycheck for some films, or he just gets a paycheck. He just whatever here.
Yeah.
Well, I was just watching Battle Beyond the Stars, which the music is so similar to Star Trek II.
Oh yeah,
it's almost ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean. But, you know, he uses what works, same with Hans Zimmer.
Mm.
You know, his scores are very similar from movie to movie, but they're just so good. And
yeah,
they fit.
Yeah, you don't mind. Yeah,
exactly. And they fit.
Yeah, you still want to just listen to the score.
Yeah. And the same thing you say about John Williams.
Yeah, honestly, it's true.
When I heard the Superman theme, I thought, sounds a lot like the Star Wars theme. but it's still so good.
It's still so listenable.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. And I don't mind. That's why I like listening. And it's really a testament when you can watch a movie, and without even knowing who the composer is, you can know who the composer is because of the style of music.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And there's times
he's got his fingerprints on it. Yeah.
I've watched movies and I thought, that sounds like a James Horner score. And then I see the credits.
Name
yep,
come
it
up.
Sure
yep,
is.
Sure is.
Yeah. Or Hans Zimmer or John Williams. Yeah. You know, but in this one, this was actually this was the first James Horner score I'd heard was the Wrath of Khan.
Okay.
And I wish he would have done all the Star Trek films.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been nice. Some of me says that, but then I think...
Maybe not the next generation.
I think they would all start running together a little
bit. Yeah, that's true.
I kind of like that they each have their own sort of theme.
No, he did 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he did 4 or not.
I don't know. That seems awfully, you know...
I don't think he did.
That seems awfully belly. I mean, there's a lot of bell and or
yeah.
you know, kind of.
Yeah,
almost,
I don't think he did 4. I know he did 2 and 3.
We could be very wrong, folks.
Yeah,
we don't have it in front of us.
We could.
Comment,
us know.
If only there's devices, handheld devices that we could look this stuff up on.
But we're not going to do that right now.
No, we'll as a matter of fact, I think it is late. We could probably stand around and talk a lot of Trek, and we could start going down rabbit holes into other Trek films.
Yeah. There's only been a few.
Yeah, there's. I think that's for another show entirely. I think we're going to call it a night. Thanks, everybody, for checking in and listening. Hope you got a chance to go and see the 35th anniversary of the Wrath of Khan in the theater. It was worth every bit. I'm so glad. I'm glad you brought it up because they did one a couple weeks ago on a weekend. I was like excited. I was going to go. And then just life got in the way. And I thought, I missed it. You know, oh, well. And then you posted like, hey, anyone interested on Thursday? Yeah. I'm like, that's right. There's another showing.
Yeah. And like like you were saying earlier, this could be the last time. It's
it's on
the big screen.
Yeah, I doubt you're going to see any of the other films. On their anniversaries come up. This is kind of like, like I said, this is the one that gave us all those other films.
Yeah.
If it weren't for this one, if it weren't for the success of this one, none of the rest of the Star Trek universe from this point forward, I don't think would exist. Not in any way that it is now.
And if you could find the, if they ever released the interview with William Shatner at the beginning, that was at the beginning of the film, find it and watch it. It was very good
And rather informative. You know, if all of it is true. I mean, a lot of it, you know, you
like
kind of wonder.
Burning the sets.
Yeah, wrong film. Yeah, like you said.
Wrong film.
30 some years ago. It all runs together for a man. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's gonna do it. Good night, everyone. Thank you very much for listening. Hope the heck you can actually understand anything we're saying. I'm not used to recording out and about like this. But we should be all right.
Yeah.
Floyd, thank you so much for bringing it up and coming out here with me tonight. And, we'll get you back on the show here real soon. And we still got to get you on Talkspace 1999.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And then we'll definitely have you back again and talk more Trek and stuff. I think we got to start, you know, hammering out some of the other Trek films and stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Good night, everyone. Bye. Big thanks to Floyd for joining me and making some time to talk on the show again. Always a pleasure, and we will be getting back to him on a talk about Space 1999. Next cool thing that has happened, this one was happening on the very day we were going to record, the 8th Annual Cincinnati Comic Expo. Unfortunately, Matt and I couldn't make it down at the same time. He went on a Saturday, which he says was packed and too loud to even attempt any recordings, so we will get more on his experience next time when we talk to him. I went down on a Sunday, which was a little calmer, activity-wise, but still plenty busy. I had a brief walk around and then started to talk to a few folks. First up is Barry Munden of the Ohio Garrison branch of the 501st. They were in full force, pardon the pun, and have been a huge part of the expo almost since the beginning. Here we are beside the Death Star Trench Run activity, talking about the 501st at the expo and their fantastic charitable work. Once again, if the Star Trek audio was rough, the stuff recorded at the expo may be more so.
All right, I'm with Barry Munden, representing part of the speeder bike pit crew, as well as a representative of the 501st. We got stormtroopers yakking behind us here. The 501st has become a huge part of the Comic Expo over the years. I mean, you take up like a good quarter of the floor, it seems, every
year. Yeah, we got 1,200 square feet.
Yeah. That's a good chunk.
Yeah, they've been really generous with space here. But we've done what we can to make a lot of interactive exhibits because the expo, the organizers really want interactivity. They want to make it a family-friendly event where you can bring your kids, and there's plenty of things to do. It's other than just buy stuff, and that's what we focused on. And we've done that for them. We've done a lot of work for them building all the exhibits, and then in exchange for that, they've been really generous with space. And they allow us to raise money for our charity, Families with ASD. It's a local autism charity. And we do very well here.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, and I was just wondering, I was pointing out, you do need the space. We have got, we've got the speeder bike. We've got a dewback, which is like, 7 feet tall?
Yeah.
And probably,
15
feet long?
Yeah.
We've got a Star Wars trench run, which I'm guessing is...
That's 24 feet long.
24 feet long, taking up a good chunk of space.
Yeah, the detention cell. Yeah, there's a land speeder now. That's motorized.
I saw that. That is awesome.
You can drive that around. And we have the Kenner card. We have the Wampa Cave, which is enormous.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a great photo op. It's really popular. And probably more stuff next year. I'm not sure what yet.
Okay, the speeder bike's kind of, or the land speeder's kind of the new thing this year.
Yeah,
every year you get a little something new.
He just got that this year.
Yeah, he debuted the trench run last year, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And he's actually got another speeder bike, and it's also motorized, but we're still working on it. It needs some repair work. His goal ultimately is to run a parade.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually have him in the parade. Yeah. That would be very cool. Well, I was commenting before as I was walking around the corner, the 501st is an amazing charitable organization. Not only does it mix the love of cosplay, the love of Star Wars, but just the love of giving and doing charitable events and earning money, like you were saying, for the ASD.
Families with ASD.
Autism
spectrum disorders.
Exactly. It's an amazing group. People don't know about it. I said, you know, one, where have you been? And B, definitely look them up.
Yeah.
You can't go to a convention anymore without stumbling across somebody representing the 501st.
Or a charity walk.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're everywhere.
Considering that it's a group that's kind of embraced what's supposed to be the bad guy.
Bad guy's doing good.
It's bad guy's doing good. That's right. They're trying to change their image after all that messy stuff with the rebels.
And we also have the Rebel Legion is also represented here, and the Mandalorian Mercs, which is the bounty hunters. And that's one thing we do here that's really popular, it's a lot of fun, is the bounty hunt. Or you can put a bounty on your friends. You know, you donate money to our charity. We give you a badge to, you know, they can wear it around the show floor. And if the bounty hunters or the stormtroopers see you out on the floor, they'll arrest you and take you back 30 in the detention cell.
Well, okay, so let me ask you this. Obviously, the expo is a huge deal for the 501st, the Ohio Garrison 501st here. Mm-hmm. Where else could people in Cincinnati or the surrounding area find you guys? Is this kind of like the big show?
Well, this is our big event, but, yeah, we do some cons, but we normally have a smaller presence. Because most cons, this is a family-run con, and so they're willing to give us more space. Obviously, they're losing money by doing this.
Right.
But they're willing to do that just to make a better experience for everybody. You know, corporate-run cons like WizardCon, not so much. You know, they're all about the dollar, so we might have a table. We're always at the Autism Expo every year in Sharonville, and we have a pretty good presence there for what's a relatively small event. You can normally find us at charity walks, a lot of the Toys R Us openings for whenever they roll out new Star Wars figures
Sure.
Yeah, we'll be promoting for Lucasfilm. Calendar always changes.
Okay. So is there?
But you can go to we have a Facebook page just like for the public. They can go there, or they can go to our website and see what events are coming up on our calendars.
What is that website?
OhioGarrison.com, I think.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely look it up, and I'll have it in the show notes. Oh, there you go. We got business cards. It's got all the information we need.
Well, you can always go to the 501st.com and request an appearance.
There you go.
Yeah. Ohio501st.com.
There you go. Ohio501st. I'm going to take that, actually. I'm going to take that card. I'll make sure that there's a link in the show notes. All right. Well, Barry, good luck. Have fun. I hope you've had a good time this weekend.
Yeah.
Continue to raise money for the ASD and just, like you said, making it just a family event.
Well, Barry was a busy guy manning the trench run and making sure it kept running smoothly. Big thanks to him for taking time to chat. That website we stumbled over is www.ohio501st.com, where you can visit the national website at www.501st.com. That's 501st.com. Next up is Bithead. Yes, Bithead. That is the name he uses, and building droids is what he does. He was showing off his hobby with a great-looking R2-D2, a power droid, and even K-9 from Doctor Who.
All right, I am here with a man who goes by the name Bithead, and he is a prop robot designer. I'm surrounded by, I've got an Imperial power droid, an R2-D2 you may have just heard. I even see a K-9 behind me. All right, sir, so robotics is your thing.
Yep, I do it professionally and as a hobby.
All right, professionally, what do you do that got you to this point? What do you do professionally then?
So I have a background in computer science and electrical engineering. I work for a company called Accenture. I run our robotics practice. I have about 1,000 people that report to me, and we build robotic systems for companies. Not like these. These are props and fun.
not droids.
But they actually do real work, like arm robots and some quads now, flying robots and stuff, yeah.
All right, but all that really plays into and helps you design, and I guess you have to kind of downscale some of those larger industrial-type robots. You have to downsize a little bit in order to fit it inside an R2 unit.
These are all remote control. I don't need to put much logic or processing in here. The ones that we build in the field, they have to be pretty autonomous. So these are all 100% remote control. I'm wearing it on my back to control R2.
Oh, very clever.
I wear it underneath an X-Wing pilot costume. so I can hide it. The big thing for me is that I want to always keep the illusion that this is a real working robot. And the little kids, I don't want them to know. If they see me with a big controller in my hand, they know right away I'm a faker.
Yeah.
Shatters
the illusion.
They call me out on it every time. Every time. But
Kids aren't dumb. They're smart.
No, they're really smart, yeah. And getting smarter. So if I can conceal it in any way, I will. And it really helps to make them feel like they've had an experience with the real robot.
Is it just fandom for the science fiction and the Star Wars and the robots and science fiction that made you decide,
yeah,
you know what, I do this. Let me see if I can play a little bit.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, these are all robots that I love and I've loved for many, many years growing up. And I said, I think others would enjoy it too if I could make it and let them interact with it. I've done some research to kind of figure out what are the most popular robots, what would be the ones that are most recognizable, it's paid off. A lot of fans come and they're really excited to kind of see their favorite robot too. So.
Excellent. Now, do you do this kind of stuff just for yourself and just to come to shows, or is it something that you would commission if someone said, hey, I'd like you to build me an R2 unit?
Yeah, unfortunately, Disney would slap a lawsuit on me very quickly if I tried to sell it. There is a R2 Builders Club, a Canine Builders Club. There's lots of resources out there for anyone who's interested in building it on their own. But for me to build and sell would be illegal.
All right, good point.
Yeah.
Silly question, I suppose.
No, I get it all the time. It's a great question.
This when you you do something like we're looking at the R2 here and everything, do you actually study just the films, or do you actually have plans that have been released?
In the case of R2, there were plans online, very easy to follow. Great, you can build them out of a bunch of different types of material, and they're very open to it. For these other two, for K9 and for the Gonk, I kind of had to wing it on my own. So I went with what I was comfortable with. I always try to push myself a little bit as far as working with new materials. So K9 is an aluminum frame with plastic sheets on top. Gonk is foam. It's 100% foam.
Oh, nice.
I poured it into a mold. Molds look like this. And, you pour the mix of the A and the B. You pour it in. It expands to fill, and you pull out the finished product.
Excellent. Very good. Well, sir, thank you very much for sharing a little information with me. You too, R2. Have fun down here at the Expo. I hope you've had a good time. Had a nice response
and
everything.
Great time. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate it.
You can check out Bithead's blog and see some of his creations at bithead942.wordpress.com. Now, you get plenty of artists at convention like the Cincinnati Comic Expo. One really stood out for me. Brian D. Judkins and his Ukiyo Pop. He blends Japanese art and the modern pop culture, and it looks incredible. He describes it better and in more detail, so I'll just play the clip.
Brian Judkins. All right, I'm here at one of the many, many vendors at the Comic Expo. I'm with Brian Judkins, who is a creator of, was it Ukiyo Pop?
Ukiyo Pop.
Ukiyo Pop. This is incredible artwork, all done in very like Asian styling. But if you look close, there's some familiarity here that might the comic book fans would definitely dive into. So, sir, tell me a little bit more about your artwork here. I mean, you describe it probably better than I could.
Sure. So we do pop culture artwork in a style of something called ukiyo-e, which is art. It started in Japan around the 1600s, mid 1600s. And it is, it's considered the world's first pop art. So it's artwork that started about vacation spots and theater and fashion at the time. And because it is such a pop culture focused style, we have a very saturated pop culture environment nowadays. So we basically take film, comics, TV, stuff that everybody knows, and we find the parallels between that and feudal Japan, and then mash the two together for some really cool artwork.
Excellent. So it really is taking the... You're not changing the theme at all.
Right.
You're just moving it into the 21st century and with today's pop culture.
Yeah. There's a lot of themes. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, sometimes we get really lucky and there's characters that are... appropriated from folk tales and stuff that do stretch back that far.
Right.
Or other times we're really just sort of calling out, you know, elements of a film or elements of a particular character that has strong parallels with some things that Japan had portrayed, you know, a good 400 years ago. And then we do work that focuses on those parallels. and let it kind of go from there.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's probably some of the most unique art I've seen here at the Expo.
Oh, thank you.
It's really eye-catching, and it's one of these things where maybe if you're not, like, a big, maybe, comic book fan or sci-fi geek or whatever, you just look at it, it's like, oh, he's got some really neat Asian artwork, you know, Japanese artwork on the wall. And it, so it's just... It's like two different worlds.
You know? I always say this is stuff you can put on your wall when your mom comes over and she won't get mad at you.
Yeah.
She'll think you're culture, but then when your friends come right over, they'll understand what you're really about.
About the only one that I think it really stands out, you can't hide the TARDIS.
Probably not. Probably not if you know what it is.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite pieces, actually. Yes. I really like that one. I mean, it's... you know, I grew up training traditionally. I want to give nice pieces. As I said, you know, when you get older, it's time to stop hanging Nintendo Power posters on your wall. It's time to get something nice. But, you know, there's subject material and things that we all care about and that we like. So it's nice to have something a little more finely crafted to put up.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking
Absolutely.
To me and telling me a little bit more about the art. Is there a website or any place that people could research or see your stuff or buy any of your prints?
Yeah, we sell everything online. You can go to ukiyopop.com, UKIYOPOP. Everything's there online. We travel all over the country to shows. We're everywhere all the time. So you can see where we're going to be next, if we're going to be in your neck of the woods. And everything is also available for line to purchase. And we ship worldwide.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, ukiyopop.com. I'll have the link in the show notes for anyone having trouble with the spelling on that one. But, Brian, thank you very much.
Absolutely. It was nice talking to you.
You too.
Yeah, you really need to see his stuff for yourself. Visit ukiyopop.com. That's UKIYO-POP.com. There you can see some samples of his work and see where he'll be heading in the near future. This next recording is an author that set up shop at the Expo, and if you see him, steer clear unless you want to buy something. He's one heck of a salesman. This is, and I take this directly from his business card, author, lawyer, teacher, biologist, guitarist, and actor, Ronald R. Van Stockham, Jr.
Hey, folks, I'm here with Ronald R. Van Stockham, Jr. He is an author here at the Comic Expo. He's selling his wares and doing a pretty good job of it too, I might say. Sir, hello and welcome.
Well, good to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Absolutely. So you're just talking, you got like the third book that you're in a series here that you're pointing out. So I'm looking at the other two books and everything. Tell me a little bit about these books and what's give me the synopsis, I guess.
Yeah, so I write two types of novels. I write magic realism and fiction science. A lot of science. I got a doctorate in biology, practice law during the day. And what I write is post-apocalyptic Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky.
But, oh, nice. Okay. Yeah,
but no zombies. No zombies. And then, in addition to that, I write short stories, and I write a Wonder of Science series, which is my way of teaching science in a creative writing style. So Wonder of Natural Life in Kentucky is one, or The Wondrous Journey of Food. In fact, I also teach a class in biology in junior college, and I use some of my text as text for the class.
Interesting. Is that what kind of got you into the idea of writing kind of pseudo-fictional novels and everything to just kind of draw people into the actual sciences and such?
Well, no, that's actually developed recently.
Oh, okay.
You know, when you're a writer, you write because you cannot not write. And if you write creatively, if you have an imagination, you write the kinds of things that fire up your own imagination. And pretty soon, you start putting your life's experience in them. Well, I'm a scientist. So my science comes in. My science is good and accurate, but also a very set in a very challenging, adventurous world. So the next step was to simply say, well, why not now take my science writing and write it in a creative fashion? Because I've done a bunch of that, and I've had real good success with it.
Oh, well, fantastic. And hopefully you're having a good success here at the Expo with
it. It's a nice Expo. It's my first time here. It's an interesting sell. Because when you sell books with a lot of science in them, you've got to talk to people about what you've got to get them past the fact that, you know, that they want to be entertained usually, not necessarily lectured to. But all of that is part of the sales pitch, yeah?
And well, these books also have some fantastic illustrations that probably help draw a few people in.
They do. Steve Eilers does all of my work, most of it black and white in the interior books, color covers. I guess he's done 400 of them for me. Oh yeah, he's terrific. He's just a real talent, and he's well associated with my work. I'm proud to be associated with him.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me, and I'm glad you've had success here at the Expo. Hope it continues. I think I may indeed pick up your first book here and give it a shot.
You're a good man.
And I'll let everyone know what I think. I'm looking forward to it. All right, thank you.
Yeah, he gave me a good deal on one of his books, the third in his Markman series, but it's one that he recommended, as he said, it ties the other two into itself. So I'm hoping I won't be lost, but I'm giving it a go. The idea of the tri-state area post-apocalypse sold me. You can learn more about him at www.vanstockum.com. That's VanStockum.com. I almost walked by this next gentleman without giving him a second look, but a few words on his poster jumped out at me, and it stopped me in my tracks. The man who shot Luke Skywalker.
I'm with Kim Simmons. He is a fashion photographer.
I was a commercial photographer.
Commercial photographer, excuse me, using the wrong terminology. He is responsible for some of the awesome shots you see from the Kenner Star Wars toy line. Now, sir, how did you get involved with that?
It just happened to be the studio that I went to work at. That's what's their main line. And once I started working, I never stopped with it.
Now, I know Kenner, when it came to the Star Wars toy stuff, they were a little unprepared for a lot of the what was to come. And they probably didn't know they were going to need something like this. Was there any sense that you were kind of coming in with a lot of people going, we don't really know, just do what you need to do?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. It's pretty much the way it was. It's you work with some really good designers, and together they created one heck of a legacy for Star Wars here.
What's some of the challenges of shooting toys effectively? Can you narrow it down?
Not today, you can't. You couldn't narrow it down that far, but it's something different. I mean,
well, what up until that point, what kind of stuff had you done commercially?
I was straight out of grad school.
Oh, really? So yeah. this was sort of like your first big project?
This is my first big gig.
Wow.
Out of grad school. So once I walked into that, it was kind of like, oh my God. It was a blast. It was an honor to work with these guys. I mean, I got to know a lot of the guys. From Kenner. I still have lunch with them.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, they're all retired, or most of them are. And got to know them. We meet once a month or once every couple of months. Talk to them every now and then. And they think it's awesome what I'm doing. They can't believe what's going on here. I'm able to sell the prints.
Yeah,
they're all limited edition. So.
Sure. I mean, it's one of those jobs that you wish anybody wishes they could have. What do? I go and play with toys all day. Yeah.
I was one of those that I had it really lucky, because not only did I shoot all the toys that I did during the 80s and whatever, I also shot Kroger ice cream.
Oh, very interesting.
From the 90s on. So it's kind of like I had the best of everything right there. I mean, ice cream and toys?
What more do you need?
What more do I need?
And now I'm retiring. Yes, I can't top this.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's it.
Did you go on to do anything beyond the Kenner? I wish I had this long list of things I knew you did. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I did other things within Kenner, before Kenner, I should say.
Sure.
Different line, different toy lines. I mean, I did the ice cream, obviously, for Kroger. I did, like, if you were in Cincinnati, you always did something for P&G.
Sure, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it did things for P&G, and pretty much a little bit here, a little bit there. That's what I did. But I am retired now.
Yeah.
I did teach at the University of Cincinnati for a while, so it was one of those things that I did.
That's Pat.
So it's now I am retired.
Yeah.
I'm on the farm with my cows and my chickens.
And now you get the chance to just kind of come and hang out at these expos, meet some of the fans of your work. And
I come in and I try to talk. I gave a panel yesterday, talked at a panel. Enjoy talking to people. That's the fun part.
Yeah. Absolutely.
To me, that is the fun. I got to meet one of the boys that I actually, he's a man now, but at the time he was a boy that I shot for the shuttle.
Oh, very cool.
And he's here in Cincinnati, and I got to talk to him. I brought him a couple prints. Because he only got to see the box, so
right.
I brought him some prints,
That's very cool. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize or just didn't know that. I mean, Kenner is a small town Cincinnati company.
It was.
And, you know, when people think Star Wars, they just think Hollywood and California and everything. But Kenner and the toy line and everything, it all came right from here, Cincinnati. So, the kids on the boxes and things like that.
There are kids from here.
Local Cincinnati people.
That's it.
Yeah, and honestly, I probably didn't even cross my mind until you just said that.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah. That now I'm kind of wishing, how come I didn't get a chance to be on the box?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. The man that was just here a little bit early this morning, literally, he was with his brother who was the model. And because he was a bigger kid, and I had a big shuttle.
Right.
He was able to hold the toy.
Oh.
He looked the part, so it worked.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, sir, thank you very much for just taking a few seconds here with me. I appreciate it. And thanks for coming down to the expo, and good luck with everything, and thank you.
Thank you.
Coolest job ever! I think I'll be looking up Mr. Simmons again for a longer, more prepared interview in the future. So, so cool. Visit themanwhoshotlukeskywalker.com. All right, this is a bit of a highlight for me. There were many media celebrities, and while many were either much too busy to get any time with or not doing any interviews at all, I consider myself very lucky to get just a few minutes with the incredible Julian Glover. And by a few minutes, I mean just a few. These celebrities are there to sell autographs, and I wasn't going to get in anyone's way. I feel I may have missed an opportunity to ask something a little bit more interesting, but that is a problem I have when I interview someone. I tend to just kind of shoot the breeze and engage in small talk before getting into anything meaty. And when you only have a few minutes, I guess you need to skip the appetizers and go straight for the main course.
Okay, folks, still here at the Comic Expo, and I'm a little bit almost gobsmacked here because I am sitting across from the incredible Julian Glover. First of all, sir, just welcome to Cincinnati. Thank you for coming. This is my hometown. It's just a pleasure to have you in town.
It's a nice hometown. I don't know it very well yet, but I like it, what I've seen.
That's the only downside when you come to do these conventions. You don't get much of a chance to actually see the sights.
That is absolutely true, which is a shame because I've been to many major American cities and smaller places as well, and I never get to see them. Well, I could, of course, stay on and have a holiday, but then you spend all the money you've made at the convention.
it's just a wash at that.
But I was out last night in Cincinnati and had a jolly good walk around downtown, and I liked it very much. That Fountain Square is absolutely great. And people really enjoying being outside and enjoying the open air, as they call it. And the warmth here is very comfortable. It's a sort of thick warmth. It's not a sharp warmth, and it envelops you and makes you feel very comfortable. I enjoyed myself very much.
Oh, fantastic. I'm glad you're having a good time. Now, you have, of course, traveled around the world doing many, many roles, going all the way back into the 60s. I mean,
yeah.
Everything from The Saint to The Avengers.
Yeah.
You've appeared in Game of Thrones, Star Wars. I mean, the list goes on. Doctor Who. When you do that, when you get the chance to travel to who knows where in the world to do these roles, is it a little bit of the same thing where you're constantly involved in the production and you don't get a chance to see some of the places?
Well, it depends on the sort of part you've got and the sort of job that it is. If you're on all the time, then you don't see the place. But if you, which is usually the case with me, I'm not in the whole film, and you get two or three days off now and again, so off you go and have a look. Like if you're in Romania, you go up into the mountains, which I did a few years ago. And or in Spain, you can travel a lot in Spain and see a great deal because it's not too big. It's the same with, you know, you go to Budapest, you get time off. But if you're only like doing an episode of a television series, you're there, you're being paid to be there, to be working. And so you don't get much time off. And, but, you know, that's the rough and the smooth. I do get around.
Right. It's the craft you've chosen, and that's one of the sacrifices, I guess.
Absolutely. And it's not sacrificial. I mean, I wouldn't go there at all if I wasn't an actor. So, and I make money when I'm going there. That's the point.
Exactly, exactly. Well, sir, I don't want to keep your time. I know
okay.
They're going to have some people coming, and you've gotten... plenty of people asking for autographs and want to meet you. And I'm just so happy I was able to catch a few minutes of your free time.
I'm very
it's
glad you did.
It's an absolute pleasure to meet you, and thank you very much.
My regards to your listeners.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Well, anyway, not everyone can say they talked with the man who took on John Steed, the Doctor, twice, James Bond, Indiana Jones, and so many others. I was no match for him. Well, that'll do it for this Stitched Together episode. In 2 weeks, Matt will be back, and we will get his take on this year's Expo, and we will finally discuss Howard the Duck. All right, everyone, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.